From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and a columnist for the website Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Jim Malone, national correspondent here at The Voice of America. And here are the issues. The threat of a military confrontation with North Korea subsided after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said his country would not launch missiles toward the U.S. territory of Guam. 14 people died and scores more were injured when a terrorist plowed a van into innocent people in Barcelona, Spain. And in the United States, the political aftershocks continue to reverberate in the aftermath of a deadly confrontation in Charlottesville, Virginia, between white supremacists and counter-protesters. President Trump inflamed the situation further by saying that, quote, both sides, unquote, were at fault. Gentlemen, we're going to start with North Korea, a little bit of good news. We've had threats coming from both sides. President Trump talking about fire and fury and saying the United States was locked and loaded. But Kim's put an end to that, at least for now.
At least for now, Barbara. I've always been of the view that Kim Jong-un is crazy, but he's not suicidal. And he has to understand intellectually. Any first strike of any sort, conventional nuclear, against United States interests would be met with overwhelming force. And some at the Pentagon, where I was just a few hours ago, like to say Pyongyang will be a parking lot if he acts first.
Sure.
So I also believe, and I believe many senior Trump administration officials believe this also, that Kim Jong-un wants a robust nuclear program because it makes him a big man on the world stage and, more importantly, perhaps on the domestic stage in his own country. This engenders civic pride and that this props him up at home. I would also suggest very briefly that maybe Kim got a little bit of religion, mixing my metaphors here, when he saw the United Nations Security Council back sanctions against him. And among those backing sanctions were China, his biggest ally, and the Russians. And so that might have given him some pause as well.
Yeah, Jim, I've always been of the view that Kim, I don't think he's crazy. I think he's brutal and clearly runs a hideous police state. But no, he's definitely not suicidal. The Trump administration has been sort of united about the issue, except for Steve Bannon, who had some very interesting remarks sort of out of the administration line.
Well, at the same time, you had Secretary Tillerson emphasizing the possibility of a diplomatic approach, and the Defense Secretary, Jim Mattis, talking about, if you do what you're threatening, we will respond militarily. Steve Bannon, in his own inimitable way, was talking about, well, you know, there's really no military option here. Nobody is realistic about the fact that if you do go to war, you know,
10 million
perhaps,
people
yeah, millions will die in South Korea within a matter of hours. So there's the whole Bannon thing, which is sort of a curious side show. For one thing, he's talking to a lot of people. The other thing here, though, that happened on North Korea, it just was such a change in a week. I mean, we had all that rhetoric last week, and it, you know, was there a method to the madness here? What I mean, is this an example of an effective diplomatic approach, notwithstanding some of the statements by the president and even Steve Bannon, the sort of Tillerson Mattis axis? Does that sort of pulled off some?
I think, I mean, Tom, that China was the key here. If you'll remember, early on in this war of words, the Chinese had an editorial, I think, in a major newspaper that basically said if North Korea started something, they were on their own.
Yeah, there clearly are intense diplomatic negotiations going on below the radar, the so-called back channel process.
Right, in New York and as well.
In New York and other places, maybe Geneva. And so maybe some of that is bearing fruit. I don't know, but the good news is that both sides seem to have stepped back from the prospects of a confrontation that could easily spiral out of control. The temperature has been lowered on both sides, and that can't be a bad thing.
Yeah, and of course this comes at a time when there are so many other crises and concerns about, in particular, terrorism. Jim, we've just had a horrific couple of attacks in Spain, in Barcelona, and at a resort near Barcelona, at least 14 dead, many, many, many injured. Lots of people involved, lots of arrests. It appears that this is quite a complicated and serious plot.
It seems as though, and we've seen a number of these attacks in, you know, the last year or so, especially in Europe. Sometimes it seems like it can be a lone wolf, sometimes a small group. But what's a little bit alarming about this is it seems to be a large, some sort of cell or something. They were discovered perhaps making a bomb a few days ago, and this set off a chain of events. And then you have the horrible use of a vehicle again to cause mass destruction. I see it set off also quite a bit of debate in Europe again among European leaders about immigration policies, particularly the Polish government warning people against, you know, open borders and so forth. But it does raise questions, you know, how extensive are these cells? What more may be coming?
Yeah. In the aftermath of actually, as the first reports were coming in, Tom, President Trump was very quick to condemn it. He put out a tweet that recapped one of his, I guess, campaign lines about General Pershing, and it's apocryphal, but very upsetting, yeah?
Well, it was not leaderly. I mean, most people remember General John J. Pershing as the commander of American forces in World War II in Europe. World War I in Europe. But before that, General Pershing fought in the Philippines against an insurrection, and President Trump has told this story about Pershing capturing 50 terrorists and dipping bullets in pig's blood and using those weapons to execute the terrorists. And there was never a problem with terrorism in the Philippines for 35 years. Yeah. It's not true.
Yeah.
And for him to just jump to that immediately is, you know, I'm hearing from Republicans that they're troubled by that sort of situation.
Jim, where did he get this from? Does anybody know where he gets these? I mean, is this something from InfoWars or of these other bizarre websites?
Wherever he gets them from, he seems to have a lot of trouble letting them go, because they, even when they are excoriated in the media as inaccurate, false, coming from questionable sources, he sees it almost as a badge of honor to just simply repeat it.
Yeah.
And then they fall back on it's the fake news trying to call me out and this and that.
President Trump sees himself in many ways. And one way he sees himself is the truth teller in chief, someone who is willing to say things that other people find inconvenient. And this is an example of that. I'm telling you the truth about Charlottesville, about whatever, and other people won't do that. And this is a piece of his very complicated personality.
Yes.
And it has gotten him in trouble before, and I think it's gotten him in trouble here as well.
Yeah. Of course, so, Jim, we've seen similar attacks like this now in a number of countries in Europe. What can you do about a van? I mean, how can you stop? You can't put up barricades in every piece of every major city.
You know? No, I mean, in one sense, this shows that they apparently are having trouble getting a hold of weapons, small arms, explosives, perhaps. But on the other hand, it shows their determination to just wreak havoc. And that kind of, that aura of fear is obviously what they want to propagate. And this kind of random thing hitting a very popular tourist area with people from many different countries, it just, you know, fits into their playbook and their warped minds the way they want this to happen.
And of course, Tom, this comes in a context of, I mean, we hardly talk about it anymore. ISIS is basically being expunged in both Syria and Iraq. So I suppose this is what we have to expect, that they basically turn themselves into Al-Qaeda 2.0.
Well, this is low grade terrorism. You don't have to have the technology to try to blow up an airliner. You just have to have a Visa card that will allow you to rent a van, and have some fanatics. It's very troubling. I will just say recently, 2 days ago, I had lunch with my 10-year-old and 12-year-old grandchildren, and they were telling me about their 6 weeks in Europe, and one of them said, 2 days ago, we had this great stroll down Las Ramblas in Barcelona, and as soon as I heard Las Ramblas, the great pedestrian mall known to millions of people in a very positive way, it was chilling and sobering, to put it mildly.
Indeed. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council and All Monitor, and joining us today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and our VOA national correspondent, Jim Malone. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast, and the program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it and tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castile. Well, I'm going to devote the rest of the show to our own case of domestic terrorism, Jim, and more. This has been one of the most shattering things that's happened in the United States in a long time, not just because a young woman was killed in Charlottesville, a young counter-protester after these neo-Nazis and white supremacists went marching through this bucolic college town, but also because of the way it's been handled by the President of the United States.
There are three images that stick in my head. The first one is the torchlight parade on a Friday night at the University of Virginia campus, with echoes of the 1930s and Nazi Germany. Chilling. The other image is, of course, the young woman, the death of her, and this horrific scene of the car smashing into a crowd and then backing up, with lots of close-up video to document it. And the third image that it's hard to wrestle with is the president on Tuesday reversing himself from the day before, and deciding that his initial instincts were right and that both sides had blame in this situation. And look, as Americans, I mean, it's a bit unnerving right now. I think we have to say that. And we are used to presidents who fill these moments of national need and tragedy with a more calming influence, with an appeal to unity, and to try to calm the waters. We've had anything but that in recent days.
Yeah, Tom. The comments were stunning on a number of levels. They have sent reverberations throughout the political system. We have seen business executives decide that they cannot be part of business advisory councils anymore, and the president basically forced to disband a couple of these initiatives, the Manufacturing Jobs Initiative and the Strategic and Policy Forum, because so many people were leaving them. We've seen the heads of all the branches of the military come out with very strong statements condemning bigotry and racism in all its forms. And we've seen really pivotal members of the Senate, also Republicans, criticize the president by name.
Barbara, I've talked a lot about what I call the man bites dog or woman syndrome. I mean, it's not a big deal. It's not a story if a dog bites a man or a woman, because that's what dogs sometimes do. And my analogy is this. Of all the criticism leveled at President Trump in recent days, I think the most trenchant was from Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. He is a learned, honorable, honest guy, conservative, but a mid-level conservative, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he said in his home state of Tennessee, the president has yet to demonstrate the stability and the competence expected of a president, and he has so far failed to demonstrate that he understands the essence of this country. Of all the words spoken, these from a senior Republican are the most resonant to me. I mean, the bottom line is, and this is the sad overview, is we have now had three polarizing presidents in a row. George W. Bush said, elect me, I'm a uniter, not a divider. That didn't work out for a variety of reasons. Barack Obama said, no, elect me, I'm going to be the real uniter, not the divider. That didn't, I'm going to be a transformational president that will bring us above race and partisanship. That didn't work out either. And now I think we have a third president who is not bringing the country together. To put it mildly.
Yeah. I can only imagine, and of course we're reading accounts, Jim, of the what's going on in the minds of people in the White House. We kind of got to watch it during the press conference in the lobby of Trump Tower. We all watched the new, barely minted chief of staff, retired Marine General Kelly, the look on his face as Donald Trump gave this press conference. What is your best sense of how the White House is getting through this? And we had talked about Steve Bannon earlier. There were a lot of rumors just a few days ago. Of course, every day in Washington feels like a year now, but just a few days ago that President Trump was going to fire him, that he was angry with him, that he was not getting along with his National Security Council directors and with Kelly and so on. Where does that all stand? And we should say, by the way, to our listeners that as we speak, there may be developments after we record this show that could change that picture.
I mean, we get a daily dose now of anonymous sort of reporting about the disenchantment of numerous aides within the White House. The bottom line in the wake of Charlottesville is, up to this point of our recording, no one has left the administration. Mm. So even though there's talk and speculation, Gary Cohn, for example, the Council and Economic Advisors chairman, was standing next to the president, was reported to be very upset, was called by numerous acquaintances and friends of him asking, are you going to stay, and so forth. One of the arguments we're hearing is that people don't want to leave because things are so shaky that they feel an obligation to stay. But circling back to Steve Bannon again, this combative nature, the nationalist approach, the need to have a battle over these cultural... Now he's welcoming, for example, a debate, a fight over whether or not Confederate monuments should be removed, covered up, whatever. He thinks that will help Trump's base and help the president. So, but, you know, is that in sync with the chief of staff, for example? It's playing out. We don't know, but it just seems there's a discordant note within the White House as well.
Now, Jim mentioned the Confederate monument issue. I mean, this was the pretext for the neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville that they were about to take down a statue from the University of Virginia campus of Robert E. Lee. General Lee, the commanded forces during the Confederacy. I mean, one could try to separate these two, although it's getting increasingly difficult.
Right. More and more cities and states are deciding that they want to remove statues. Some would say this is our history, and we cannot ignore our history. Well, even President Trump said in a tweet, we have to learn from history. But of course, he's very much opposed to removing these what he called beautiful statues.
Yeah.
But I'm somewhat conflicted. I mean, the practical problems are many. There's something like a dozen or so military bases named for Confederate generals: Fort Bragg, North Carolina; Fort Lee, Virginia; Fort Jackson, South Carolina. It's a And what do? Do you change those all to Fort Jones or Fort America or Fort... So there is a danger of going overboard. But on the other hand, the fact that many of these statues, in the view of those who want to pull them down, are these aren't just rank-and-file Confederate soldiers. These are monuments to generals who are the architects of treason against the United States of America.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it comes out, but I do think more statues are going to go before this stops.
There's an argument for putting some of them in museums and taking them away from courthouses
and city halls. So
for instance, I'm waiting to see what happens in Richmond, because many of our listeners have been to Richmond, the last capital of the Confederacy. There's a beautiful street called Monument Boulevard that goes from downtown north of the Capitol, and there's a whole series of monuments to Robert E. Lee, to Stonewall Jackson, to the soldiers and sailors of the Confederacy. And it's hard to imagine Monument Boulevard just a series of pedestals. How do you deal with that? And where's the middle ground? The most unfortunate thing about it all is it has divided the country even further on race than it was before.
I did, Jim, want to mention that while there is no moral equivalence, there was another side to some of the disturbances that took place in Charlottesville, and that's a group that calls itself, I believe, the Antifa, for anti-fascists. I've been doing some reading about them. They came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement, some of them. A lot of them, I mean, frankly, it takes me back to my student days. They look like sort of garden variety anarchists and other assorted ultra-leftists who became violent at a time when people were trying to peacefully protest the Vietnam War.
Well, it's interesting, too. They have some roots that go back to, say, the Seattle World Trade thing at the turn of the century.
Anti-Davos,
which,
that kind of thing.
Which, you know, in a weird way, they have something in common with the Trump base, and that they are anti-capitalist or anti, you know, jobs going overseas.
Anti-globalist,
Anti-globalist, exactly. But the other issue on this monument is... The Charlottesville showed, I think, that these fringe groups, the neo-Nazis, the Klan types, are going to try to use the monument issue to further their agenda. So will the debate stay on that? Or if it becomes more of a straight on, do we eradicate our history? If it's just a battle over what do we do about these monuments, I think you're going to see some Republicans digging in, especially from the South. They're not going to go along with, like, even though Nancy Pelosi has already said we should pull all these things down in the Capitol, for example.
One quick poignant note. I think one of the things that makes this all so poignant on a personal level is Charlottesville is the home of the University of Virginia, founded by Thomas Jefferson, the architect of the Declaration of Independence, who, it must be said, was a big slave owner himself. So all these cross currents make this even more difficult to fathom and to deal with. But the poignancy of this happening in Mr. Jefferson's hometown makes it even more poignant.
It does indeed. And I think these, you know, many of these issues of race and so on that Americans thought they had dealt with and put behind them, clearly we have not. I think there are a lot of concerns that there are going to be more Charlottesvilles. And but just again, for context, the columnist Ross Douthat of the New York Times had a very good column this week where he said, look, this is really terrible, but it's nowhere near the level of breakdown that we had in the 60s and the early 70s. Do you know that there were 2,500 bombings in 18 months during Richard Nixon's first term? We had many clashes in the streets. We had Black Power. We had anti-Vietnam. We had the counter demonstrations, and of course, the Vietnam War was raging. So I don't want to say we should feel better about ourselves, because we certainly shouldn't. But I guess one can hope that this is going to at least trigger a really deep introspection on the part of many Americans, maybe not on the part of our president, but many other Americans about where we stand.
The only thing I'll add to that is it, politically, though, it does feel like a different time, because in that time, there did seem to be more of an opportunity in the middle to persuade or work together or compromise. The politics now in recent years has become so tribal that that seems harder to patch together.
Indeed. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. And I want to thank our panelists, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor, National Journal, and VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward, and our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin. I direct the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and I'm a columnist for the website Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.